afternoon and welcome to the Jason Rand Show on a gorgeous Friday on AM 770 KTTH. We are streaming on the KTTH smartphone app. Thieves are apparently using a sly tactic to steal from storage units in Seattle. It's probably going to come to a neighborhood near you. That is what's trending.
What's trending? Crime.
The story comes to us from Fox 13, and whenever someone does something in a new and sly and innovative way, of course, when it comes to crime, we pay close attention because we want to make sure that we don't fall into the exact same trap as someone else. They say despite layers of digital locks, surveillance cameras, gated access, a self-storage unit was broken into. Ryan is the victim. He tells Fox 13 that he lost about $10,000 worth of valuables, including a prize guitar, high-end woodworking tools, an art collection that he had amassed, expensive camping gear, and other stuff that I'm presuming you're not going to be able to produce receipts for. And I would totally say that I lost a whole bunch of things that I didn't even own because I think it would give me more money. But I'm not actually saying that about Ryan, but that's how I would do it. That's how I would handle it. According to Ryan, they broke in a unique way. They used a tactic that they call simply renting a unit under a legitimate name, and then they were able to get in, and then they were able to break in. It's actually quite simple. It's not all that innovative, although I suppose it's something that we didn't really think about.
They know what they're doing. They know these facilities. They know exactly where to cut. This isn't specific to that location. It's multiple locations around the city. They had to have gone systematically from front to back, opened up every box, emptied out, and then thrown back in a huge pile. Probably over $10,000 worth of stuff. They rent out a unit in someone else's name, so it's a legitimate unit, but then they just go through and hit different units, open them up, take stuff out, and put it in their own storage unit.
It's actually, again, it's not innovative, but it is kind of smart, I suppose. The problem, of course, for Ryan is not just having to deal with this, not having to go through the process of trying to, number one, figure out what was stolen, what the value was. But then you got to go through the process of going through insurance or even through the storage unit company. In this case, the name of the storage unit company is StoreQuest. I've never heard of them. It's on West Marginal Way in Seattle. I think that's over in Magnolia neighborhood, StoreQuest. But they said, or Ryan said, actually, insurance doesn't really cover all that much. And the unit itself, the storage unit business, they're not liable for this kind of theft.
The storage unit isn't really liable for all that stuff, and the insurance policies only cover up to like $5,000. And so I'm looking at all this stuff that I spent so much time and energy and education accruing, and I don't know how I'm going to get that stuff back.
And really, I have to imagine that that's the toughest part. It's not necessarily the cost associated with all of it, although obviously that plays a role. But I'm not going to pretend that at least getting about $5,000 out of the $10,000 is, you know, it's better than what I was expecting him to say. But I imagine the idea that, look, I have sentimental attachment to a lot of what was stolen. I spent maybe years and years and years acquiring all of this stuff. Now, it is, and I don't know the circumstances in which he put his items in this storage unit, because to me it indicates maybe you're not as close to the material as you're saying now. But for all I know, he could have put it in there for, you know, a weekend, right? Or just a month, because he's in between apartments or business offices. So there's all sorts of different reasons. I don't know what is to be done to prevent something like this from happening. If you're using a fake name and you've got the fake documents, and you were able to, you know, convince the people behind the storage unit business that these are legitimate documents. I don't know what we expect out of a storage unit as far as proving someone's documents to you are real, right? Like, I just don't know what they're supposed to do, what kind of tactic they can take. What, do they look at every single ID and then ask the person a question about what's on it, just quiz everybody? No, of course not. So I don't know if you're going to be able to really do anything about something like this. I would argue that The only thing to do is to highlight that it's occurring. Surveillance footage is available, so we know at least what the woman kind of, we know what the woman looks like. We can't tell what the guy looks like because he's wearing a hat over his head, but the woman was dumb enough not to wear any head covering, so you can see her face pretty clearly here. It's not a great photo because all surveillance footage outside of Ring cameras are just really crummy. I don't know if we're going to be able to catch this guy, but the King County detectives are saying, hey, here's the information, here's what they look like. If you have any contact with them, make sure that you tell us so that we can go ahead and investigate, make the arrest if we need to. He filed a police report with SPD. This guy, I imagine, Ryan, who knows what is for sale, and the detectives who know what's for sale. I imagine they are looking at some of these different websites like OfferUp or whatever the new Craigslist is, where people oftentimes, if this is part of a retail gang or if this is part of something a little bit more organized, it's obviously not like just a random shoplifting by a homeless drug addict. This is a little bit more sophisticated than that. You know, they usually go onto these websites and they sell those products. And if you have a, you know, a prized guitar that is not even necessarily rare, but you've got artwork obviously that is not going to be easy to pass off as like, you know, one of the thousands of prints of something else, because again, he says it's worth something, you should be able to at least identify, and that's how the online being sold, and that's how the detectives are able to work. I will also point one thing out, because I do, he is a victim here, but I've changed my mind and decided that they're not as prized possessions as he says. And maybe he treats them like they're not prized, but they are. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. But I'm looking at the photos of the storage unit with the items in it, and it's all over the place. Everything is just strewn around. And I can't tell if he's to blame for this or the robbers. You know what? It's Friday. It's a nice day. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt. He's not the one responsible for this. The thieves are the ones who just went through everything and threw everything around, even though it seems kind of hard for me to believe that all of this is a result of that. But still, I'm going to side with him because the bad guys are the bad guys. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? International.
Just a few hours after Israel carried out its strike inside of Iran, sending a very clear message to Iran, yeah, we can take you on if we need to. You saw what we did with your missile barrage, which was the best you had to offer. Here's what we can do with just a simple, very targeted and limited attack. And if you want us to go even farther, okay. Know that we're capable of doing that, and we can end you as much as you think you can end us. Not long after that, you had Secretary of State Antony Blinken speaking. He was talking about the sort of the priority for the G7 on supporting Israel. He made it clear that at the end of the day, the U.S. didn't have anything to do with this. However, they were aware. We know that they were aware of the strike, and Israel gave them the heads up because they wanted to prevent them from, one, looking like fools by not understanding what's going on and being just taken off guard. They didn't want to do that to an ally, unlike, you know, the United States taking Israel off guard by demanding another election. But Secretary of State Blinken talked about what the priority is now moving forward.
All I can say is that for our part and for the entire G7, our focus has been on de-escalation, on avoiding a larger conflict. And actually, that's been true since day one after the horrific events of October 7th. A big part of our approach has been to prevent the conflict from spreading, to avoid escalation everywhere. And that's a common policy across the G7. And it's very much our approach now. So we've been engaged in efforts to avoid escalation. Those efforts will continue.
Yeah, and look, it is in all of our interests to de-escalate at this point. We said it in the first hour that the fact of the matter is right now, Iran and Israel, by their muted response to what happened, I think is sending the message that, yeah, they don't want this to continue. And if you're Israel, you don't want it to continue because you just don't want to have to deal with that as you're dealing with Hamas. But, you know, you're not too worried at this point if the traditional way that Iran fights, which is just lobbing over these slow drones, you're not too worried about that. But again, you don't want to have to deal with that. You just don't. If you're Iran, you definitely don't want to have to deal with Israel right now. Now, the leadership in Iran, as we said, kind of had a muted response. Very, very tiny comment here or there. There was a speech earlier today by Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi, and he didn't mention the missile strike by Israel at all, like nothing. Instead, he was focusing on the offensive attacks that Iran was engaged in last weekend, calling it Operation True Promise. He said it led to authority, unity, and cohesion in the country. Today, all political groups and factions believe that this response was necessary and a big honor for the country. Now, this is nothing but propaganda, of course. He is gaslighting his own citizenry who do not support Iran. Iranians overall are very, very, very pro-Israel and pro-Western culture because of the way that they're treated, but they don't have enough power. That's an unfortunate reality there. But the Iranian people are not like virulent anti-Semites. I think you have way more of that going on with Palestinians in Gaza than you do in Iran. Now, part of the issue with Palestinians in Gaza is that they've been hit with indoctrination since they were young. So it's not like they had a choice in the matter when you think about it in those terms. If you're being indoctrinated, if you're getting hit with propaganda since birth, you're going to start to develop these feelings towards what you now perceive to be an enemy because that's all you learned. That's all you know. Iran, it's a little bit different. The fact that he is pretending that what they did was this wild success last weekend further emphasizes the fact that they want to see this go away. They're now in de-escalation mode. Now, that, by the way, doesn't mean that Iran won't get more involved via its proxies. I just don't imagine that this is going to really impact Iran's willingness to fire again from their own home soil. So, again, we'll see. Anything's possible. If I were Israel, the only thing I'd be not even worried about but aware of, and I'm certain that they are, is that Passover is next week, and that might make them particularly vulnerable, or at least that might be perceived as making them vulnerable. I don't think it would, because they're probably thinking that, yeah, they probably are going to strike on Passover. So, again, we'll find out. I'm a little wishy-washy on this, on presuming what's going to happen next, because you never really know when we're dealing with the Middle East. Let's find out what else is trending.
What's trending? Celebrity news.
I know the name Jelly Roll, but I have not heard any of his music. In fact, I didn't even know that he was a country music star. I thought he was doing hip-hop, and perhaps that's on me for judging a book by its cover. It's a very big cover. But I kind of love this next story. It comes to us from Fox News. Here's just, for those of you who aren't familiar with Jelly Roll, here's his hit song, Son of a Sinner.
I'm just a long-haired son of a sinner.
I kind of dig this. Actually, I'm kind of digging this. I like country music, but I don't really know country music all that well. I could actually, you know what, during the break, producer Jackson, remind me, please, to download all of his music on my Apple Music playlist. Yeah, that was good. Anyway, Jelly Roll is in the news because of an interview he gave with Entertainment Tonight, and they were focusing on the fact that he's someone who likes to give back. Now, the backstory for him is that he served time. He served time. And his reaction to what that was for him, what he experienced, what he got out of it is somewhat unique because we generally don't hear positive stories upon release. Every once in a while, obviously, people say that it changed them and now they give back to the community. But we generally don't hear that from the highest profile people, right? But he said that he helped launch a music studio inside of the Juvenile Detention Center in Nashville, Tennessee, which is precisely where it is he once served time. They say that a portion of the proceeds from his Bridgestone Arena headlining show back in December of last year and a couple of events earlier this year ended up funding this particular program. And Entertainment Tonight included a quote in their story from the press release of the program saying, "This collaboration featuring music luminaries Jeffrey Steele and Ernest," I have no idea who those are, "alongside 35 pro hit songwriters who helped kick off the program launch, embodies the belief in music's role in personal growth and redemption, showcasing the journey from juvenile detention to success." Now, he's someone who previously said, this is all about bringing hope to people. And he was inspired through his faith, which obviously got stronger and stronger and stronger after he got out of juvenile detention.
It's been probably one of the most driving forces. Faith was a lot of me believing it was going to work out for me. Could you imagine being a 37-year-old unsuccessful musician and you told people that was your job? And they were like, you know what I mean? It wasn't like something I did on the side. Like, it was my job. And I was just, you know, I just always had faith that God had a bigger purpose for what I was trying to do. Not everybody has to make a deal with the devil in this business. You know what I mean?
Now, back when he was 18, for those of you who don't know the story, he was charged with 2 counts of aggravated robbery. He was then sentenced to 8 years in prison and 7 years of probation. This is a guy who very easily, post-jail, could have just said, I'm not going to be able to overcome all the baggage associated with spending time in jail. We hear this all the time. That once you go into jail, you're at a complete disadvantage and there's nothing that you can really do to overcome that. And while that's certainly not true, it's certainly accurate to say that it's tougher. Maybe it might depend on the crime and the amount of time you serve, sure. But even if you spent some time for a low-level crime or 3 or 4, whatever it happens to be, you know, that's not easy to overcome. And yet, not only did he overcome that, but he became a huge success. Now, his story is not going to be the average one. We know that. The average person who gets out of jail doesn't become an artist, right? Doesn't become a working musician to the point where, you know, you're winning awards, you're getting a huge record deal or 3, and you become this kind of an overnight sensation. And for me, Jelly Roll is that overnight sensation because I never really heard of him until the last, you know, half of a year. At the end of this, it reminds me of the conversation we had earlier in the week about juvenile criminals and how we might be failing them by not putting the resources into juvenile detention that are necessary. And that's just not about staff members and making sure that they have access to, you know, good therapists, but it's about giving their lives some structure and some meaning. And while I think it's a little overstated for the press release, you know, the power of music can transform. It can, sure. But, you know, dial it back. I think faith plays a little bit more of a role. But, you know, it's certainly true that if you've got kids who are already going down the wrong track to the point where they're in juvenile detention, and you're able to find one of their passions that they could actually use all that energy that they have to learn more for or towards, you can, in fact, see some successes afterwards, or at least give off the impression that you're trying really hard so that people, and I shouldn't say give off the impression, it sounds like you're faking it, but if you're trying and people can tell that you're trying, they're going to be more willing to give you a second chance or a third chance or a fourth chance, right? If they believe that you're trying in good faith. And too often we have situations in which not only are we failing these kids, but when they leave, they don't have any passions, they don't have any support system, and they just go back to where it was they were before, ultimately leading to a life of crime as an adult in which they get popped again. If not, they get killed. They're either going to spend more time in jail or they're going to spend time in an early grave. And that is a failure on society if we can look at the situation and say, be honest with ourselves and ask whether or not we're doing all that we can for criminals. And I know that that's a weird kind of way to talk about these things. I totally concede that. But when we're talking about low-level crimes or nonviolent crimes, crimes where you know the person is going to come out of jail for, it's in our interest to help them get back into society. It's going to be hard, and I don't expect victims to want to do that. But the system itself, I think, needs to just do a little bit of a better job in reforming these people, because otherwise you get a movement like BLM that steps forward and says, oh, hey, guess what? The criminal justice system is inherently broken because look at all the recidivism. Look at all of the people who return to prison. It clearly doesn't work as a disincentive. And so their response is not to better the system, but to dismantle it and keep people out of jail. Right? That's what they intend to do. And they were successful for the last 3.5 years, and we're now living with that consequence. But if we do what we can so that there are more, I can't believe I'm saying this, jelly rolls out there, then all of us benefit. As a society, the individual benefits by not creating future victims, and we're just doing the right thing. It's going to cost us less in the long run as well. So I wish people would take that kind of approach to putting people in jail, with some exceptions. I do not hold that view of people who are murderers who are going to spend the rest of their life in jail. I don't care whether or not they feel like they're now on the right path, but they're going to have to spend the rest of it in jail, but they'll do some good from jail. I'll take it if they go down that path, but I'm not worried about spending that much time specifically catering to them. I want to spend time, if I'm going to go in order of importance, the younger the criminal, the more time I want to spend trying to get them to rehabilitate themselves. So if we're talking about the 14-year-old like Jelly Roll at the time going into juvie, or an 18-year-old or a 24-year-old, those are the ones who have a long life ahead, assuming they don't return to a life of crime and then have a premature death. And I just think if we thought about the Jelly Roll type of stories, I can't believe I just said that again, maybe we'll be inspired to say to ourselves, hey, we can do better. Not everyone is going to be lost because of what they did as a youth. Doesn't mean you forgive necessarily, doesn't mean you forget, but it does mean that you have an open mind and realize that they're going to come out of jail, and I would rather them be on the right path than the wrong one. And I certainly concede that it's sometimes hard to just wrap your head around it, because for me, it was hard to wrap my head around that idea. 1-800-465-8770 if you want to weigh in. I'd love to hear from you. 1-800-465-8770. You are listening to The Jason Rant Show.
Will there be fallout from Israel's strike on Iran? We'll check it at 6 a.m. on Monday morning on The Brian Suit Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Here to react, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rant.
And the rise of soft on crime laws and policies have made it worse.
Our man in the Pacific Northwest, Jason Rant, is on that.
And you keep on bringing us these extraordinary stories from Seattle. It's amazing.
Long form.
When it comes to talking about the environment, you usually hear from two different sides. One side saying there's nothing changing whatsoever. In fact, it's always 76 and breezy outside. And then the other side says, well, tomorrow at noon, I think the world is going to end because of global climate change. And the truth is, we have on the conservative side ceded this issue to the radicals on the left, when we have a lot more in common with the environmentalist movement than I think most people realize. That's why I am so proud to tell you about a new book that just came out this week by my friend. It's called The Conservative Environmentalist: Common Sense Solutions for a Sustainable Future. Benji Backer is the president of the American Conservation Coalition, where I serve as an advisor, and he joins me now. Welcome back to the show. Congratulations on this new book.
Hey, it's great to be here, and it's great to finally have this out in the world, the first conservative book on the environment in at least the last few decades.
And it makes a lot of sense to, as a conservative, embrace this. The problem behind not embracing the environmentalist movement as it is that it's been overrun by progressives, and the ideas that they have are antithetical to everything that conservatives stand for.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And I mean, we are losing a whole generation of people because we aren't proposing our own agenda. It's kind of like Obamacare or something. When you don't propose your own idea to another bad idea, you end up getting the bad idea that you don't want. And for decades, Republicans have kind of ceded this issue to the left. It's been kind of intellectually lazy of us. You know, in our tribal culture, it's easier to just jump to the other side and just attack their ideas. While their ideas have been harmful in so many ways, and I talk about that in the book, there also is a very realistic path forward that doesn't put people at odds with our environment. And that's what the left has made us feel like we have to do.
How do you overcome the reluctance from someone who is conservative to go ahead and pick up the conservative environmentalists because they don't want to be associated at all with the radical left?
Well, I'd first say that you don't have to be associated with the radical left to embrace environmental challenges. In fact, I think it's really critical, and this is why the book is titled The Conservative Environmentalist. Environmentalism used to not be a right or left issue. Republicans believed they were environmentalists. Conservatives believed they were environmentalists. My message to those people would be, you can do that again, and you can do it in a way that's authentic to your values. You don't have to buy into what the political left has been saying to consider yourself part of the environmental movement. But if you don't lean in, we, again, are going to lose. And this is something that, you know, conservatives truly care about. Conservatives are often the people who hunt, fish, and hike and spend time outdoors. You want to be at the table on this. Not only are you losing politically by not engaging, but you're also losing the opportunity to fight for something you believe in.
The other thing that I think is important to point out for this book is you don't only go over what can work and what does work and what is very clearly aligned with conservative values, but you point out the problems with progressive ideas so we can actually push back and have informed conversations, informed debates, and then, you know, push for the ideas that we think would do much better. And one of the examples that you give in the book, a little midway into the book, was the downside of solar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I talk a lot about kind of the problems that Jay Inslee has had on the environment, and same with Governor Newsom. They're probably the two I focus on the most. But I actually think they're a perfect example of what you shouldn't do. And one of the things that I talk about in the middle of the book as it pertains to solar is it's like, you know, if you live in Arizona or you live in Nevada, considering solar for daytime power is a decent idea. Putting up a solar panel in Seattle, Washington might sound good on a, you know, political statement, but it actually doesn't do anything in the real world. And it actually ends up being pretty harmful because you have to mine so many minerals in places like China and Africa mm-hmm. and other parts of the world because we're refusing to do it here at home, which is a whole other problem. But you're basically spending all this energy and destroying the environment to then not even be able to use the solar panel once it's put up. And it's like, we should, if we're going to use wind turbines, we should only put them where they're windy. If we're going to use a solar panel, we should only put them where it's sunny. If we're going to put a hydropower plant, we should only put it somewhere where there's water. You know, like there's some really simple things that people on the political left haven't been thinking about. And it sounds good to put a solar panel on your roof, but if there's no sun, then it's actually not doing anything and you're just wasting resources and we should be looking at other energy sources too.
What are some other energy sources that you think makes the conservative argument?
Well, I think honestly, natural gas and nuclear are the two best examples. I mean, I'm pro renewables, so I don't, you know, I think that that's going to be part of the energy equation in the future. And I do think that we should be taking more of that production back to the United States when China's dominating that market. But China's also dominating the market for everything else, too. And that includes nuclear and natural gas. And they're building more of that every single day than the United States could ever dream of. And nuclear and natural gas are both clean. They're both reliable. They're both 24-hour, 7-day-a-week power sources. They work when the sun is not shining and when the sun is shining. And there's also the cost aspect. Obviously, nuclear is very expensive at first, but over the lifespan of a nuclear plant, it's incredibly inexpensive, and that's with the old technology. Natural gas is obviously incredibly inexpensive, and it's actually worse for the climate. This is the case the book makes. It's worse for the climate if you care about pollution in the atmosphere for us to shut down natural gas in the United States because the demand will be met somewhere else in the world and then it will be shipped over to the United States. And so you're wasting a ton of emissions by shutting it down here at home when it's sounding like you're trying to save the planet. So natural gas and nuclear are huge. I think geothermal is going to be a big part of our future in the United States and also will be a great way to get people in the oil and gas industry, other options for jobs as well. I think it's in any of the above strategy that we have to take.
I'm talking with the author of a brand new book. It's called The Conservative Environmentalist, Common Sense Solutions for a Sustainable Future. It's out right now. Benji Backer is the author. He's the founder of the American Conservation Coalition. You've heard him on the show many times before, so I hope people go out and purchase the book. One just irony in all of this is one renewable energy source is hydropower, and yet here in Washington State, you have Democrats, and then at the national level, certainly seems like the Biden administration going after our hydropower infrastructure.
Yeah, I mean, it's really silly that the Biden administration and Jay Inslee have focused in on solar and wind alone. And in fact, I talk about the book, over half of the Green New Deal, which is kind of the mentality that they've been buying into, is focused on EVs and solar and wind alone. And so they're basically saying, these are the three things that are going to help us save the planet. And look, I believe that carbon emissions are a significant problem. And I do think that we have a planet to protect and an environment to protect. If you're saying that those are the only things that are going to help protect the environment,
we're screwed.
It is so backwards. We actually are screwed. The environment is screwed. Because every time that we're not, you know, pursuing nuclear, every time we're not pursuing hydropower, every time we're not pursuing geothermal, every time we're not trying to work with farmers and ranchers and foresters on the solutions, every time that we're vilifying these people, we are losing the war towards a better environment. And so they're actually, and I think a lot of it's not intentional that they are like actually trying to harm the environment, but they are unintentionally harming the environment in the name of the environment.
Why don't they see that?
I think it's because they can't get out of their own bubbles and their own echo chambers. I mean, you have these activists gluing themselves to banks and buildings and streets and throwing stupid paintings and stuff like that. And they're scared of those people, and they're listening to those people because they're scared of them. And those people are incredibly ill-informed. Yeah. And they're saying fossil fuels are the enemy, that nuclear is really scary, and hydropower kills fish and hurts tribes. I mean, they're basically have this fear-mongering mindset on everything. I'm a little bit confused why those people who are pushing for those things on the ground, who Biden and others are listening to, don't also call out the human rights violations of the mining for solar panels in China, or the mining for lithium in Africa for our EVs. Like, every energy source, you could everything has a trade-off, and there's truly a negative to everything that we do to try to tap into from a resource perspective. But to ignore the trade-offs on solar and wind has really kept us in the dark as a country, and it's really kept Joe Biden and others in the dark as well.
So now the behind-the-scenes stuff that I love to talk about with authors, now that I've experienced probably the same thing as you. You obviously did the audiobook version as well. You and I both made the mistake of recording it ourselves. What was the process like for you? Oh, my God, I have trauma still associated with that.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I was really scared about reading the book and not being proud of it, because I hadn't really read it fully through in a long time. You read it piece by piece, you read it chapter by chapter, and you're editing it, and you're just really not like thinking about it. And it was actually pretty cool to see it come together in that way. But man, sitting in a room for 3 days in a row for 8 hours, just staring at an iPad, reading off of the reading off the script. Was pretty difficult, but I'm glad it's in my own voice. I'm glad yours is in your own voice. We wrote it, so you know it's good that it sounds like us, and I'm glad the people who are listening aren't listening to someone random.
Exactly.
But man, that was a hard process. And but I was also, when I got done, I was like, wow, that sucked, but I also love how the book turned out. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, that's always a fun piece. And what people I don't think realize is that there's no AC in the room, because it would be picked up on the microphone.
No.
So you're just sitting there sweating. And I remember doing this on a Saturday. It was just happened to be really warm out. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm feeling kind of sick. And boy, did I puke after that show. Oh, my God, I was done.
Oh, my goodness. I will say I drank a lot of caffeine, and I also was locked in ways that I really shouldn't have been. It was a crazy experience. I have ADHD, so you know, sitting behind an iPad is not necessarily what I wanted to do, but it was worth it.
Yeah.
And I hope that people who don't like to read and would prefer to do it in an audiobook version do take a listen, because I think it's better when the author does it.
Yeah, and if you've got Audible credits, go ahead and use it. Do it. You're not using it for anything else. The Conservative Environmentalist, Common Sense Solutions for a Sustainable Future by Benji Backer. It's out now. Make sure you purchase it. Benji, my friend, thank you so much for stopping by. I appreciate it.
I've always appreciated our partnership. Thank you.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rancho. When we come back, we're going to dive into some quick hits right here on KTTH.
The Jason Rant Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rantz. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rantz is in focus now.
Jason Rantz, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
There's a little bit of a trend as it relates to homelessness stories this week outside of Washington State. And it's interesting how parallel both of these stories are, how similar they are. But they're basically running on a parallel structure of you've got Multnomah County, which includes, of course, Portland and Oregon. But then you have the entire state of California running into the same issue. They're spending a whole lot of money on, you know, quote-unquote solutions to homelessness. And yet, they're not only not seeing any results, even if they were seeing results, they wouldn't really even know it because they're not tracking it very well. I mean, it is pretty remarkable when you think about it. I mean, we're talking about lots and lots and lots of money. And yet, they're not properly tracking. So let's start first in Multnomah County, because Multnomah versus Portland, from an infighting perspective, I find just fascinating because you know they both can't fight. And so it must be them just like trying to slap each other while turning their head away. You know how like people do it when they're young? Both governments created something called the Joint Office of Homeless Services, J-O-H-S, also known as JOS. But they haven't been operating together very well, that according to the Willamette Weekly or the Willamette Week. They said the department has been operating without consistent data to guide their efforts for the last 8 years when it was founded. That despite the fact that they're getting hundreds of millions of dollars, taxpayer dollars, every single year to distribute out to people in need, nonprofits, social workers, etc. There's a line from this KGW report that should just freak everyone out, embarrass everyone. This is the line. One of the biggest criticisms of the joint office over the last few years is that nobody in the system seems to know who specifically is being helped and whether it's making a measurable difference. JOHS does report the number of people helped, maintaining an online dashboard with the data. But it's impossible to know if the count include only unique interactions or if, for example, one person was helped multiple times. Now, that's obviously a problem. I don't always need to have that data external, but they should have it internal for sure, because you want to know if you're dealing with someone who is chronically homeless. There's a difference between how you might treat someone who's chronically homeless versus someone who just became homeless. One is going to be considerably easier to deal with than the other. And obviously, if you're trying to create these relationships with individuals, you might want some, notes on the individuals to see what is and is definitely not working. And frankly, when dealing with the chronically homeless, it's mostly about what's not working. And if you're not going to embrace sweeps and you're not going to include the criminal justice system, then you better have those notes. Because you need to get a little bit inventive, I guess, or innovative. And obviously, that's not happening. Now, the reporting from the Willamette Week talks about how the office hasn't had this specific information since its inception. And I guess no one stood up, raised their hand, and said, shouldn't we be gathering this kind of stuff? It seems kind of important, right? No, no one? Oh, no, see, there's someone in the back. I saw someone raise his hand, you know. Nigel Jekies is a reporter with Willamette Week. He spoke with KGW about what it was he found in his story. And they say, he says, you know, just getting control of the system in which data is distributed, not just collected, but distributed, took about 8 years.
Yeah, it's really remarkable. Since the joint office was formed in 2016, you would have thought that that system would have moved over from where it used to reside at the Portland Housing Bureau almost immediately. There's been a lot of wrangling between the city and the county. There's been a lot of conversation. But in fact, it took nearly 8 years until March 25th for the county joint office to get control of the system.
Like, that is insane. That is insane. And he points out that the information that they do have, just from a basic understanding of the crisis, is pretty much useless because it's inaccessible and it's incomplete.
I think that anybody would recognize that in any human endeavor, data is helpful. So who's out there? What services do they need? What services have they used in the past? you would be able to analyze from that data what projects or what services are effective in reducing homelessness. We really haven't had any of that data. The limited data that the system currently contains is largely inaccessible to the nonprofits who provide services. It's largely inaccessible to many of the government partners. And the data itself is very incomplete. So the consultant who looked at this said there are about 50 different things that you would like this system to be able to tell you. It can only tell you 8 of those.
Oh, God, just 8. Just 8 of the data points. So the people who are doing some of the work, maybe some of them are doing really good work, and we don't know it because, well, the data isn't being tracked. And most importantly, we don't know the ones wasting money, not doing great work, that we could be booting from getting any funding so that we can then funnel the money to the organizations or the workers who are doing good work. You can't track that information if you're not tracking information. Meanwhile, in California, they spent $24 billion over the last 5 years just on homelessness, except similarly to what's been going on in Multnomah County, they didn't consistently track whether or not the spending helped the people who needed it. This according to a state audit that was released this week. They say an estimated 171,000 people are homeless in California, which amounts to about 30% of the homeless population across the country. And despite the fact, according to the AP, that they spent about $24 billion on both homeless and just housing programs between 2018 and 2023. Not only did the problem not improve in many cities, the state auditor's report itself struggled to figure out how effective the spending has been because of how poorly it was being handled. The data points, again. AP says, among other things, the report found that the California Interagency Council on Homelessness, which is responsible for coordinating agencies and allocating resources for homelessness programs, stopped tracking spending on programs and their outcomes in 2021, despite the continuous funding from the state. It also failed to develop and collect, evaluate, and just generally review the outcome data of the programs because they didn't really have a consistent method. A consistent method to actually do any of that. Now, they said the report notes that some data regarding the number of program participants and bed inventory in the state system might not even be accurate or reliable. They've only reported on homelessness spending once since its creation in 2017. And AP says, without reliable and recent data on its spending, quote, the state will continue to lack complete and timely information about the ongoing costs and associated outcomes of its homelessness programs, that according to the audit. Now, specifically, we're talking about 30 programs that end up getting funded here. And they were looking in this audit at 5 initiatives, but only found 2 of them that were actually being adequately tracked, specifically to turn hotel and motels into housing and a housing-related support program. And of those 2, they said, only they're likely cost-effective. Maybe not totally, but likely. That they haven't done this kind of data, that no one has called this out, shows you what we mean when we talk about the homeless industrial complex. Not everyone likes that phrase. I don't even particularly like the phrase. It sounds almost conspiratorial, but this is what we mean. We are giving money, tens of millions of dollars, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars in the long run, to nonprofit groups that never seem to get a handle on the crisis, and yet somehow they get larger and larger and larger budgets. Tax dollars keep getting funneled through. Grant money keeps getting funneled through. The responsibilities grow for some of these organizations, and yet when you ask them, well, can you point to any success stories? And they just don't. Now, maybe it's because they have no success stories or they don't know how to get that data. Either way, it's a problem. You're using tax dollars for this. That's called wasted tax dollars. If we're going to spend money, and we obviously have to spend money on this, and I'm fine spending money, a lot of money, because ultimately I think it's a moral thing to do, but also it gets to the societal interest. So I'm okay to pay for it. But I'm not okay to pay for programs that aren't being tracked, results that aren't being tracked, and concerns not being addressed based on the data points. I'm not okay just constantly giving more and more and more and more money to these organizations that are very, very, very bad at what they do. And it just so happens, the longer people stay outdoors, the longer people are homeless, the longer it goes without any true solutions, the more money they end up making. You shouldn't be making hundreds of thousands of dollars at these nonprofits if you're not able to show us results, meaningful results. It's disgusting what's going on. And this is happening here in Washington as well. 1-800-465-8774, your text. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show.